It's season 2, episode 7 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. Welcome back. I'm Gita Pensa. One of the many hats I wear these days is as a coach who helps prepare defendants for their appearance at deposition or trial. And by the way, if you are new here, I'd like you to hit season 1 first and certainly listen to the episodes on deposition and trial, and you will learn much more about what is required for a deponent or a trial witness. But one of the things we focus on a lot is how we communicate in each of these realms, which are very different from one another. And yeah, the truth is the truth is the truth, but there is an art in communicating the truth. And you know that from being a doctor or other clinician who works with patients. The way you break the news of a life-changing diagnosis to a patient is different from the way you communicate that to a consultant. The way you convey data or test results is different. The way you communicate with your kids is different from how you talk to your friends, is different from how you talk to your partner. So let us dispense with the notion that learning how to communicate well and strategically at deposition or trial is somehow distasteful or wrong or dishonest or something you don't deserve to do because of the medical events that took place. We're going to talk about all of those things some other day. But today, let us just take that as a given and learn a little bit more about strategic communication from a true expert. I am so excited to welcome Matt Abrahams to the podcast. I am a huge fan of his. Matt Abrahams is a lecturer who teaches strategic communication at Stanford Graduate School of Business, and he's the host of the Think Fast, Talk Smart podcast, which is where I first encountered him. He's the author of books such as Think Faster, Talk Smarter, which came out in 2023, and Speaking Up Without Freaking Out, 50 Techniques for Confident, Calm, and Competent Presenting. He's published research articles on strategic communication, cognitive planning, persuasion, interpersonal communication, and he is just a wonderful and innovative educator and coach, and I admire him greatly. I refer clients to his podcast and books for techniques in maintaining their calm while they're in the hot seat and communicating with empathy, professionalism, and simplicity. And today, I am so excited to welcome him to the podcast to talk about strategic communication for defendants in litigation. And I hope you enjoy our conversation. Matt, thank you so much for coming to talk to us on the podcast today about strategic communication.
Absolutely. Excited for our conversation.
So I think this is going to be novel for most of the people who are listening to this podcast, not communication as a concept. Communication plays an essential part in the practice of medicine overall. But I've invited you here today as a strategic communications expert to talk about communicating in some high stress and artificial environments that doctors may encounter. And that's really doctors testifying in the course of a lawsuit at either deposition or a trial, which are two very different things, as we've talked about in this podcast before. But the majority of doctors will be sued in their careers, and we receive so little preparation or training on it. And even though that's not exactly what your podcast, Think Fast, Talk Smart, or your most recent book, Think Faster, Talk Smarter, are precisely about, I often refer people I work with to your podcast and your book for tips on anxiety management in speaking, and the importance of preparing and creating structure and communicating with empathy and clarity and brevity and distilling complex topics down into simple, compelling arguments and letting their values and perspectives shine through. And so after that long-winded introduction, would you be up for talking about these things with me in this context?
Absolutely. And I look forward to learning from you more about the context. I do a fair amount of work with doctors. I do work at Stanford's medical school helping doctors and those training to be doctors. And I certainly do a lot of work in the legal profession as well, have many clients who are part of law firms, but haven't really thought about how those two merge together. So I'm excited to learn from you.
Well, so first of all, let me say this. I had never heard the term strategic communication before I listened to your podcast. I mean, when you hear the term, you can kind of guess what it's about. But it's not a term that doctors hear in their training, even though we try to communicate strategically with our patients. So as a professor of strategic communication at Stanford, how would you define it? How would you define it?
Yeah, so strategic communication is really at the highest level about having goal-focused, audience-centric communication that's deployed through various channels, striving for clarity, striving for consistency, and in many cases, to be motivational, compelling, influential. So that's at the highest level. You know, very practically, it's about honing and developing messages and the delivery of those messages, be it written or spoken, so that we can have maximal impact on the people we're trying to communicate with. In essence, we communicate strategically all the time, but it's really about the forethought, the goal, thinking about the channels, thinking about the needs of the audience. Those are the types of things that we talk about in the classes I teach and in the work that I do.
I think that doctors are okay with this concept in terms of dealing with their patients, but something happens when they enter the litigation arena and testifying at deposition and trial, even though they're two completely different ball games, you know, performing in either really does require strategic communication. But a lot of doctors that I work with sort of bristle at the thought of being strategic in their communication in litigation because it feels to them like it means they're not being genuine or forthright. And even though they don't feel bad being like that in conversations with patients in this weird domain, thinking about communicating with persuasion or strategy feels sneaky, dirty, underhanded, and they just sort of want to show up with their unvarnished truth. And just sometimes they resist preparation because it feels ethically strange to them. So what would you say about the value of these communication skills in this arena?
I'm sorry to hear that people feel that way. I mean, I think if your goal as a communicator, regardless of setting, is to get your point across, then being strategic about it makes sense. We are strategic often in our communication. So when I say strategy, I don't mean being conniving, manipulative. It's really about how can I best represent my ideas in a way to maximize fidelity, accuracy, and clarity in what I'm saying. As medical professionals, your job in communicating is to communicate with high fidelity, to communicate clearly. And I would expect that in this domain of legal issues around medical malpractice and other things, that being clear is really important. So I would encourage everybody to see strategic communication as essential in all of your work, but especially in these circumstances. So going into a deposition, going into a trial, thinking through what's important for you to get across. What are the key points? What are the types of stories I want to tell, the evidence I want to bring? Thinking about historically what this means relative to things that have happened before, the work that I'll do in the future. All of that makes a lot of sense to do in any high-stakes circumstance, especially one that has some legal context around it. So I bristle a little bit when people equate strategic communication with things that are negative. I think strategic communication is incredibly positive and incredibly important. And everyone in any high-stakes situation, be it in the legal system, dealing with medical issues and challenges, even in our interpersonal relationships with friends and family, need to spend some time thinking strategically. The last thing I would say is that to be authentic, to be your true self, you do that through communicating, and you do that by communicating strategically. So I think it's really important that people spend the time thinking this through. It's not a necessary evil. It is a critical component of being successful in whatever capacity, whatever job you do.
I love that. It's not an evil. It's a critical component. I thank you. I'm going to use that. To shift gears for one second, one of the things that you do so well is to coach people with tips on anxiety management in speaking, and whether a prepared speech or speaking extemporaneously, and trial is sort of a weird combination of both of those things. But, you know, physicians have a lot of experience with speaking in anxiety-provoking arenas. Like when we start off as students, we will have to do these patient presentations in front of medical teams that are filled with more senior doctors who are judging us and We do case presentations, and sometimes we have to defend our choices at conferences, like morbidity or mortality, that sort of thing. You know, we present research, we do talks. We always try to communicate complex topics simply to patients. And, you know, each of these things creates some kind of anxiety in us, but there are very few events in a medical career that cause as much anxiety as giving a deposition or testifying at trial. We feel these are very, very high stakes situations. We are unfamiliar with the setting. We probably have complex emotions about the medical events and being in the lawsuit that are all going to come into play. So, what advice do you have for us regarding managing our anxiety to help us communicate better in these scenarios?
Yes, and thank you. I appreciate that you refer people to the work I do. I have dedicated a lot of my life to helping people feel more comfortable and confident in high-stakes situations. Certainly the situations that you address are very high stakes and have big consequences. So anxiety is normal and natural. I believe, and those of us who study it believe, it's innate to being human. And I'm happy to go into why we think that's the case. But the reality is, in high-stakes communication situations, we feel threatened and our body invokes fight or flight. Speaking to doctors, those listening, and yourself, clearly you understand better what goes on in the body when one is activated by a stressor than I do, but it is normal and natural. And when it comes to this, the ways to manage it, and manage it is a key idea. It's not about overcoming it. I don't believe we truly can ever overcome our anxiety in speaking. There will always be situations that invoke it. However, we can learn to manage it. There are two ways primarily. First, by managing symptoms and managing sources. So the symptoms are the things that happen to us physiologically, and there are things we can do. For example, our heart beats faster. Obviously, we're trying to oxygenate our bodies. We breathe more shallow. Simply by taking deep belly breaths, like if you've ever done yoga or tai chi, can calm you down. And I'm sure you and others better understand why that is than I do. What is important is the exhalation. It's the exhale where all the magic happens. So make your exhale twice as long as your inhale. It'll slow down that heart rate. It'll slow down your breathing rate, which will also slow you down. Your voice will sound more normal and natural. Shakiness is adrenaline. Adrenaline's purpose is to move us from threat to safety. So purposeful movement with broad gestures. If we're standing, moving around, if we're seated, when we say something important, we might lean in. That productive movement reduces some of the shakiness, and that's really important. I blush and perspire when I get nervous. That's because your heart's beating faster, your body's tensing up, your blood pressure's going up. You get hotter. It's like you're exercising. So cooling yourself down can help, and holding something cold in the palms of your hand helps. The palms of your hand are thermoregulators for your body, just like your forehead or the back of your neck. So I will hold something cold, like a cold bottle of water, before I speak, and it reduces my core body temperature. Everybody's done this in reverse on a cold morning. Holding something warm, like a warm cup of tea or coffee, warms us up. So those are some things we can do to manage symptoms. There are lots of sources of anxiety, things that initiate and exacerbate our anxiety. One example is the goal we're trying to achieve. If you are on trial or being deposed, your goal is to have your story be told and understood accurately. If you're actually on trial, it's to be found not guilty. And we can get very nervous about the potential negative outcome of those events. If I'm found guilty, if people don't believe my point of view, if I don't convey it the appropriate way. All of those are about the future, potential negative future outcomes. So the way to help ourselves is to become very present-oriented in the moment. And anything we do that makes us present-oriented helps. So it's doing something physical, some light exercise. Actors and actresses will shake their bodies out. Talking to somebody, having a meaningful conversation before you go in and get deposed or sit in the courtroom can help you be more present-oriented. Anything you do that helps you feel the moment, the present moment, rather than worrying about the future can help. And that's just one example of many ways of managing sources. So I apologize for giving a mini lecture. It boils down to managing symptoms and sources. And those are things that we can do and work on to help us feel better in those moments.
I'm so happy to actually hear you talk about coming into the present moment, because I recently on the podcast talked to a defense attorney who employs mindfulness and the practice of mindfulness and tries to get his defendants to engage in the practice. And hearing about that value from more than one source and an expert communicator like yourself, perhaps will further validate that people can try it at some point and that it definitely has some value. So you talk about in your book, you talk about the development of an AMP or an anxiety management plan, we've talked, you know, at length about anxiety on this podcast, about litigation stress in general. What do you advise people to do in terms of their own personal anxiety management plan before they have to go in and perform?
Everybody responds differently to anxiety around speaking, and everybody finds solace in different techniques. My original book, the first book I wrote, was called Speaking Up Without Freaking Out, and it was 50 techniques for managing anxiety based on academic research. I'm happy if 3 to 5 of those 50 work for any one individual. Not everybody is the same. So finding a personalized anxiety management plan is really important. So what works for one doesn't work for the other, and you have to try these things out. It's trial and error. And you need to do it sooner than later, right? So if the trial's coming up in several weeks or months, I need to start thinking about what will work for me. So let me share with you my anxiety management plan, what I do. And I still get nervous in certain situations. They're fewer and farther between, and they have certain characteristics. So over the years, I've been able to really define and refine what makes me nervous and how I can address it. But everybody needs to find different ways of managing and different plans. My plan consists of techniques that involve me doing something physically and involve me doing something mentally. And I think that's really important. And my plan allows me to do some of this right before I speak, as well as in preparation and even during. So I have 3 steps that I follow. First and foremost, I already alluded to the fact I hold something cold, and I start that in advance. Maybe 5 minutes before I go speak, I start drinking some cold water and holding it. That reduces my blushing and my sweating. I also remind myself that I have value to bring. One of the things that can be very intimidating to me and to many people is the fact that we feel like we're being judged, that people are criticizing us. And that's real. People do judge you. In a court of law, you are literally judged. At the same time, in most of our communication, we have truth to bring to the situation. We have value to bring. There's a reason that I'm there. And reminding myself of that makes me audience-centric. So has me focus on the value of my message to the people I'm speaking with. So I have a mantra. My mantra is I have value to bring. And then the final thing I do, and this sounds a little silly, is I will say tongue twisters out loud, not in public where people see it, but this is to get me present-oriented. I can't say a tongue twister properly and not be in the present moment. And it has the added benefit of warming up my voice. I am shocked by how many people expect to be able to go from silence to brilliance in their communication without warming up. If you're an athlete, you know you should warm up. If you exercise, you should warm up. We should warm up our voices. So before I ever speak, I do those 3 things. That's my anxiety management plan. I've been doing it for years. It really helps me. I encourage others through trial and error, find techniques that work for them to help themselves feel better in their communication.
I love that. So I want to talk for a second about in the moment now. So you've managed, you've done these things ahead of time. You're getting yourself in the right mindset to perform, essentially. When you're in it, sometimes you realize something didn't land the way you wanted it to, or, you know, you're worried about the reaction that you're getting from the people listening to you. And one story you tell in the book is about famous Coach K at Duke University and the mantra he used for his players, which is next play. And I love this. Now I use this when I'm teaching physicians to stay focused when they feel like they didn't articulate something well or they're flustered. Can you tell us about this concept and how it helps us to stay focused in the moment?
Yeah. So I'll give you a little origin story on this. I have 2 boys. They're now young men, but as they were growing up, they played a lot of basketball, youth sports. And we had an amazing coach. He's a friend. He's a neighbor. Awesome guy. And he was teaching the kids that a lot of kids, when they make a mistake, they feel really bad. And they sit and wallow in that rumination. One, it's not psychologically good for them. But 2, the game is going on and they're missing all the other stuff. So he introduced them to Mike Krzyzewski, Coach K's rule that he would teach his basketball players, which is next play. Your job as an athlete, I would argue your job as a human being, is to really connect with people, be present in the moment, and then immediately move on to the next moment. If we sit in rumination, staying in the past, we miss what's happening in the present. So this notion of next play is simply move on. So if I'm shooting a basket, I miss the basket. Instead of sitting there wallowing in despair, I have to run down the court because the other players are going to shoot against my basket. Similarly, if you have an amazing shot and it does really well, you still get back down the court. So it's about this notion about being present and moving on. It does not mean that we do not reflect. Reflection is critical in any skill development, especially communication. Reflection happens after the fact. not in the moment of the communication. So there's a difference between rumination, which happens in the moment, and reflection, which happens in the past. And this is a valuable skill for many things. There are several mindset changes I talk about in the book, Think Faster, Talk Smarter, but in the coaching and teaching that I do, this is one of them. Don't get bogged down by what has just happened. Stay present, stay moving forward. That said, we also have to reframe the errors that we make. Many of us fear making mistakes. We see them as bad. We see them as affecting our credibility. It's normal and natural to make mistakes. When we were children, we made mistakes all the time. It's how we learn. I have a reframing of mistakes, and I call it missed takes. You know how movie producers and directors, they do different takes of a scene. Maybe the actor stands, maybe the actor sits, maybe they look this way, maybe they look that way. Each one's a different take. No one is right versus the other being wrong. They're just different ways of doing it. So when I say something I didn't intend to say, rather than beating myself up and ruminating, I simply say, take two. Now I'm going to do it again or do it differently. And that allows me to not be bogged down again in rumination and help me move forward. So this notion of next play and missed takes pair nicely together to help us feel good about our communication in the moment, and they set us up to reflect after the fact.
I think that's especially important when someone is preparing for giving a trial or deposition. They'll often be given a mock deposition or a mock trial, and we will make mistakes there and just beat ourselves up over that and then develop anxiety around it. And so I think that concept of just we're learning from this, we're going to be able to do it again, seeing it as a, you know, a missed take and something that we can get better at while we practice, I think is really important. In your book, you told a story about being a tour guide in college. And I have to mention that I was also a college tour guide.
Right, right. So we've got that connection. Yeah.
I also can walk backwards and talk to groups of people. But this story was as a backdrop to talking about the importance of preparation and structure, even in spontaneous communication. So in both deposition or trial, we have no idea actually what questions we are going to be asked. But we do know that at some point, they're going to come back to our medical care, our medical chart, our decision making in the case and trial. And at trial, we'll get the chance to tell our story in somewhat more detail. And we're going to have a narrative about why we did the things that we did and how we thought about it. And how can preparation and structure help us here, even though we won't exactly know what we're going to be asked about in the moment?
So structure, I believe, is key to effective spontaneous speaking. When you're put on the spot in the moment, you have to focus on what to say and how to say it. And structure tells us how to say it. I work with many medical professionals who have to give information to their colleagues as well as to patients. And it can be really hard to synthesize all the material you have to say, responding to a question or input, for example. And it's equally hard to package it up so somebody can actually remember it and act on it. Structure helps you do both. Structure is nothing more than a logical connection of ideas. A good tour guide structures the information that they give. They set expectations up front. Structure helps you do that. They connect ideas together. Structure helps you do that. And they leave you with information that's memorable. Structure helps you do that. So a structure, and I'll give you the one that I teach doctors and lawyers all the time. It's three simple questions. What, so what, now what? What, so what, now what? What is the information you're conveying? Maybe it's the diagnosis. Maybe it's the treatment plan. The so what is why is it important and relevant to the person or to this moment? And then the now what is what comes next. So if I'm giving a diagnosis and treatment plan, I might say, you know, you have this illness or condition. The treatment plan is as follows. This is important for you because it can reduce the harm or increase the potential success of the outcome. And here's what I'd like you to do next. So by thinking to myself, what, so what, now what, it helps me prioritize what to say and to say it as concisely and clearly as I can. And second, it packages it up nicely so somebody can remember it and act on it. So structure serves many purposes. It sets expectations, connects ideas together, makes it memorable, and it takes off that burden from all of us of what is it that I need to say in this moment? Because it tells you how you will say it. I'm a lousy cook, but if I follow a recipe, I'm much more likely to have success. That's what a structure does. If you're on the witness stand, if you are in a room being deposed, if you're talking to a patient, structure will help you be more effective.
I believe that. And I think, you know, at trial, we're going to be telling the story of what, so what, and now what is not like what happens next, but what did I do next? Why did I do that? And presenting that information in a logical way so that people can understand you and the sequence of events about which you're talking, I think is absolutely critical. Another thing I think that is really crucial at trial is to be able to communicate with genuine empathy and clarity and brevity. And you have to teach the jury, who are non-medical, about often complex medical topics in a way that they can follow and understand. And expert witnesses also need this skill. So what can you tell us about the importance of empathy and clarity and brevity when you are breaking down a complex topic into a way that a non-medical juror might understand it better?
That question has lots of parts to it. So let me start with empathy. Empathy is critical. The reality is we all suffer from the curse of knowledge. We know too much about the things we talk about, and therefore we might make assumptions, we might leave out details, we might use acronyms. The only antidote to the curse of knowledge is empathy and curiosity. You have to be curious about what your audience knows and what they think, and you have to address and adjust your communication to that. Many people argue that the reason our species developed the ability to communicate was to be empathetic. So empathy drives communication. So we have to think about the other person's perspective. It's incumbent on us being successful. The biggest mistake people make in communication is they start from the wrong place. They start from thinking, what do I want to say, rather than what does the audience need to hear? So empathy is critical. We have to be able to appreciate what the other person needs, the jury needs, the lawyer needs, others. That's number one. Number two, often in these circumstances, complexity is all over the place, and we need to make that complexity accessible to people. I don't believe in dumbing things down. I don't believe in oversimplifying. We just have to make it accessible. So how do we do that? Maybe we walk through things step by step. We diagram it. Maybe we break it down into constituent parts. Maybe we use analogies and comparisons or images and pictures. These are all tools that help us take a complex idea and make it more accessible so people can understand it and act upon it. So this notion of empathy and accessibility are really critical in our communication, and we have to spend the time thinking about it. Now, structure also helps, because structure helps us be concise in those moments. The problem with many people, especially in the circumstances you and your podcast address, is what people tend to do is they just list information. They itemize points or a chronology. Our brains are not wired to remember lists. In fact, I challenge you, how many items do you need to buy from the grocery store before you have to write it down because you're afraid you'll forget? For me, it's three. So we're not really good at remembering things. So using structure takes us away from listing things, which makes our content more concise, which can really help. So you brought up three really important points: empathy, accessibility, and concision. And those are really critical to effective communication.
Now I just need someone to remind me to bring the list that I made. If someone could do that when I go to the store, that would be very helpful.
No, exactly. Well, that's what cell phones are for. And soon AI, right? So AI is going to help us with all of that.
Right. I'll just ask, what was it that I was thinking that I needed?
Or it'll just tell you. You don't even have to ask.
All right. I have one last question for you. And this might be the hardest. Certainly, when I think about how to articulate this to people, I find it very difficult. One of the most difficult things when we're in litigation is the adversarial nature of it. And whether or not you feel like your decision making is defensible in hindsight, most of us go into medicine because we care deeply about people and we develop this skill set to help them. And when anything goes wrong and litigation is threatened or started, we're not able to talk to the patient anymore. And oftentimes trial is the next time they're going to hear anything directly from you, either the plaintiff or their family, in this weird artificial setting, of course, which is set up to be adversarial. And I believe that it's very important to not only have empathy for the jury in that setting and what they know and understand, but to have empathy for the plaintiff and their family, and to be able to display that empathy in your communication while simultaneously defending yourself. What advice do you have for us in terms of being able to communicate our defense, but in a way that still offers compassion for the plaintiff and when the audience is potentially hostile to our message? I mean, the questioner, the plaintiff's attorney, is hostile, but that's not who our answers are for. So what are your thoughts on...
That's a big one. That's a big challenge, right? And there are some correlates to that in other types of communication. When it comes to conveying empathy, one, you want to be authentic and true to yourself. Don't become somebody that you're not. Second, acknowledging the emotion that's at play, and emotion is at play in these circumstances. You know, even in a court of law that's all about facts and what happened, there's emotion, and acknowledging that, saying this is something that's really personal to me, and I'm sure those involved feel very connected to it. I mean, acknowledging that is important. Sharing that you understand that there are multiple perspectives to this, or there are multiple approaches, is also important to conveying empathy. When possible, demonstrating listening. So in a deposition or when you're on the stand, when somebody asks you a question, asking a clarifying question, paraphrasing what you've heard, all of these demonstrate your intent to try to understand it well, which means you're trying to connect with the person. So how you do it in terms of your approach, in terms of the language you use, those are really important. Paraphrasing, using language that's inclusive, but also what you do with your body. Are you open? Are you closed? Are you leaning forward? Are you leaning back? All of this conveys interest, intent, connection, and empathy. Granted, the circumstance that you're talking about, which is adversarial, which has an outcome that might be detrimental, it's hard to remind ourselves that being authentic and connecting can actually help us. But it is through the words we choose, the approach we have, and what we do with our bodies and voice that help us convey that empathy.
Thank you so much for that answer. And thank you for coming to talk to us about this topic in an arena that I recognize you haven't really coached around specifically, but so much of the work that you have done offers us instruction and information about how to tailor our approach in this arena. And so I thank you for that. And I really appreciate your time. It's been great talking to you.
Well, thank you. I've enjoyed not only talking to you, but also learning from you about this environment. And I'm grateful that you find value in the work that I do. And I hope it helps people to get through these very tough situations. So I appreciate your time, and I appreciate the opportunity to chat with you.
All right, my friends, that's all for today, and I will see you back here in a month or so. For my lawyer and my risk management friends, I am excited to say that I will be delivering the keynote address at the American Bar Association's Health Law Section Conference next month. That's September 26th in Chicago, and I hope to meet you there. And if you haven't yet watched the documentary A World of Hurt, How Medical Malpractice Fails Everyone, please make sure to watch and share it. It's under half an hour. It's available on PBS apps and YouTube for free. And I will see you all next time.